Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Oh, yes, it's true. Don't try to deny it.
Hi, man. I'm going to deny it.
Oh, okay. I don't really have any way to prove otherwise.
Checkmate.
Thanks, Descartes, you jerk.
Gentlemen, we are still experiencing the effects of The Force Awakens, just totally dominating the box office like never seen before. And we're not going to talk about the movie itself, so don't worry, folks. There won't be any spoilers here. As far as we know.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that there's an article in Variety today which talks about how this has been a record year for movies, but it's been a smaller number of movies which have been making the lion's share of money. And there's a great book, I think it was called Blockbusters, which I pitched to you a while ago.
I did. I read that one. It was good. It talked about the math just works out where you should, instead of making a bunch of good movies, you should make a wild spread – throw all your money at wild spreads, increasing the odds that that one of them will be a runaway hit.
That was a different take than I got.
Well, it was like your diversified portfolio. It was basically go for the big – well, actually, no, now that I think about it, you're right. That was a big theme where it's like, look, you have to hit these things to get a blockbuster. So just do these things. Why are you bothering getting experimental?
The idea was double, put all your money basically into a fewer, put instead of spreading across, you know, instead of doing, you know, 10, $50 million movies, do four, you know, $250 million or whatever the math is. The idea is do the bigger bets, because in order for a movie to really make money, it's got to be a colossal hit right now, a colossal hit. Now, there are smaller studios, Blumhouse and whatever, that'll go in there with like $1 million movies, and then they'll decide to put $10 million into marketing it. But what's happened, like the tent pole has become the big thing. The tent pole has become the thing where, no, we're going to spend $300 million on this movie, because if the $300 million movie succeeds, then we'll make $1 billion from it.
It's a bit more like the way drug companies think, right? Where it's like you have to cover your R&D, so you got to have a blockbuster Viagra or whatever.
Yeah, because the cost now to create awareness about stuff is huge. And part of the reason where Force Awakens worked, because number one, it gets the name Star Wars. Number two, it gets the biggest brand in the world, Disney, backing it, which owns so many platforms and has – I've sat down with some of their marketing people, and these are people who came from places like Google and elsewhere, who are pure quants talking about how they do their analytics to approach it. You know, we talked about this before, 24 hours after – they run a commercial. They've already planned a new commercial for going on the next night. So you have Star Wars, you have Disney, and then the third most important factor is it's a good movie.
Yes. In fact, I was thinking about this. Where does it rank for you guys amongst J.J. Abrams movies? Is it the best J.J. Abrams movie?
Yes. Next question.
Well, I mean, let's go through what it's competing against. I liked the first Star Trek remake a lot. I think it's
So I would say, I mean, like in whatever order you want to put them in, it's Mission Impossible 3,
which to be honest, I wasn't crazy about,
and Star Wars, right? His reboot of Star Trek and Star Wars, right?
And yeah, Super 8.
Oh, and Super 8, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but I think we can. I don't know. For me, if Mission Impossible, if in those three, I mean, I don't know. Is anybody caping up for Super 8 as his best movie?
No. As a matter of fact, I'll call it. Yeah. No, you're right. It's certainly the best J.J. Abrams movie ever.
Because I would say if you're going to look for a tiebreaker, there's more new characters in Force Awakens than there are in, you know, he's making us fall in love with Captain Kirk in Star Trek.
Although I will say that first Star Wars movie, I definitely was crying within the first 5 minutes of the film.
Star Trek.
Come on, whatever. You fake nerd.
I loved his Star Trek. I thought that his Star Trek did in it, and but he did a lot of JJ-isms on him, you know, the JJ shortcuts, which I was okay with, because also it's like I don't hold Trek up with the same amount of veneration that I do Star Wars, in that, you know, there's a hell of a lot more Trek out there that's just way across the spectrum. And we had the original Trek movies were every – the even ones were fantastic. The odd ones were, you know, what the F. I thought his Trek was great. I thought he did a really good reboot of that. And I liked Into Darkness, even though we go – you know, we can all point out flaws. I thought Force Awakens had far fewer flaws that annoyed me, and I just enjoyed it over and over again. And I'm going to look forward to watching it again. And my love of Force Awakens takes nothing away of my appreciation for his Star Trek.
Yeah. No. I was just, you know, yeah.
Real quick, random side jag. I don't know if you guys caught it on Twitter over there. I want to say it was within the last week, but Rian Johnson, of course, is of Looper fame, is pegged to do the next Star Wars movie, and there was somebody on Twitter that was haranguing him, saying like, "Oh, you better not do this, and you better not do that, or whatever." And Rian Johnson just tweeted back a still image. He publicly quoted this guy's tweet and only put on it the image of Cartman dressed as a bratty 16-year-old girl saying, "Whatever, I do what I want." Like there's no text. It was just Cartman in that mid pose. It was amazing.
That's well. Speaking of Twitter, and I didn't bring this up in Weird Things. There was a after SpaceX launched, and there was a congratulatory email from Brad Bird, who was the director and one of the writers of Tomorrowland, and congratulating Elon Musk. And I wrote back to him like, "Wait, didn't you have your character in Tomorrowland try to blow up SpaceX's launch pad?" Which it was true. I mean, she was trying to stop construction, or trying to sabotage construction of the SpaceX launch pad, which in Tomorrowland, you see her, it's launch pad 39A, which is the one SpaceX is revitalizing.
Oh, that's launching. Hilarious.
And that got a rebuttal from Brad Bird, who cited my tweet, said, "No, she's a big..." I think Doc Jensen, who's the, you know, who's a co-writer of Tomorrowland and a writer, so I think Doc Jensen and I would agree that she's a big fan of SpaceX, da-da-da-da. And so I wrote back, "I stand corrected." And then Doc Jensen says, "No, you're paying attention. That's great." And he wrote a very, you know, kind response to me. But I'm like, that's the funny thing about, you know, Twitter.
So, oh, dude. Well, it reminds me of the time back when we were doing the old NSFW show. We were proposing the theory that Toy Story 3 had a Brazil-like ending from the movie Brazil, where it's like pretty much they die in the garbage chute, they get incinerated, and everything after that moment is a fantasy that's being manufactured because it's so over the top, the fact that they get rescued, and just, of course, they find a new family and everyone lives happily ever after. And that drew a rebuttal from the director of Toy Story 3. It was amazing.
Yeah.
They're listening, folks. They're listening. Whether you subtweet or at reply, they will find you. These creators will.
But to be honest, I think it's great because it, and, you know, maybe that could be our topic for After Things is.
Because you want to know what? I think that they're super thin-skinned to be looking at every little piece of feedback, okay, and not being calm like I am when I review the Amazon ratings for The Contender. One 2-star review who says that we're a ripoff of Cards Against Humanity, despite the fact that we have very clearly different mechanics and we've evolved the genre of a party game, and he's wrong, clearly and demonstrably.
I think I got retweeted by Rian Johnson once too, or something too. A couple years ago, before he was doing Star Wars.
There is something kind of magical about the fact that Twitter seems to be an honest back door to the souls of these creators, because you can have an honest conversation. There's something about the inherent brevity of Twitter that makes it easy for busy people to peruse and respond to, and because there's no expectation that we're going to get into a deep philosophical discussion or whatever. I don't know. I think it's absolutely wonderful.
Especially the post, you know, there's like a generation of directors, including Rian Johnson, who were on Twitter when they were promoting their independent movies and have a relationship with Twitter that I think is really super awesome, that, you know, you're just seeing a lot more people who are like on the medium before they had gigantic products to plug.
Yeah, there's something. If you grew up with the medium, you can handle, I think to a degree, you can handle people telling you you suck. You know, you can look at your feed and see a bunch of you suck. So you can be like, okay. Where people who are a lot of Hollywood people who have been so insulated from criticism and everybody around them is telling them that anybody doesn't like what they do is stupid or whatever. And they don't tell them. They live in that bubble. If you live in this bubble and you see people like, hey, I'm going to take a time out from Twitter or whatever, it's because these are delicate flowers that just don't understand what's really going on in the real world. And then there are certainly exceptions of people who become subjects of just wrongful attacks or hateful stuff. But largely a lot of people who put out critical stuff and they're like, no, or put out stuff that, you know, artistic stuff that gets attacked or whatever. And they're like, oh, I'm shutting down Twitter. It's like, well, you know, guess what? This is what the world is really saying.
Man, and that's the tough thing is because right now, you know, we're on the side of the savvy and the young who are able to say like, no, this is the world you live in. It's going to be heterogeneous and you're going to have to deal with criticism and it's incumbent upon you to, you know, keep everything in perspective or whatever. But, you know, biologically, 20 or 30 years from now, there's going to be something we don't get and we're going to be in that space where we're going to be tempted to say, oh, I really like this bubble that I'm in. Let me just shore up the edges of this bubble so I don't have to see so much of that outside world.
I don't think that everybody, you know, 60 or over is in that bubble. I know
I'm not saying it's inevitable. I'm just saying we're going to be faced with that temptation. I think we're...
Yeah,
we're,
no, I hear. Absolutely. I agree. And I think that becomes down to a testament of personality. I know there are a lot of people who are, you know, in their 60s, 70s, 80s who are... very active, very able to contribute, very much aware of what's going on and aren't engaging of this sort of stuff. And I hope that's where we fall on the curve. And also because the people who've pioneered this technology, this medium, are actually slightly older than we are. So, you know, they gotta I wanted to – back to the whole idea of the tentpole thing though. It's a very interesting thing that comes into play where there was a book by, I believe it was Chris Anderson, who was the editor of Wired, which talked about before, called The Long Tail. And that was sort of the theory that the future was going to be, you know, all these products have a very, very long tail to these things. And and Blockbuster was sort of kind of a counter argument to that and said, no, you know, the thing that the long tail sort of, and this is me extrapolating my own opinion, but ignores is that you're going to get a million long tail products where it becomes sort of meaningless. That, you know, you look at the number of ebooks on Amazon right now, and it's, you know, we went from the traditional publishing industry putting out 200,000 books a year, which is more than anybody could read, and now you have like 2 million books a year being published on in ebook form, and that quickly masses to the point that there is no long tail unless you're actually able to sort of drive stuff. But even then, like, you know, the sales of my top selling book far eclipse all of my tales.
Yeah, the plus on top of that, I'd be interested if you've taken advantage of this at all. And we tried to most recently on our current sale at scamstuff.com. But Will Harris a few months ago sent us a copy of the book The Curve. Did we already talk about it on After Things? I know I've talked a bit about it to you guys. Oh, great. That'll be my pick. Is a book. I haven't found it on the American store. It definitely shows up in the UK store. But The Curve is a book that breaks down sort of the surprising genius of in a world where music becomes available for free, how does one survive? And in the case of – it begins with the case study of Trent Reznor, who at the height of fear about music piracy or whatever released four albums, Ghosts 1-4, and said, all of you can have it for free. I've got an honesty box. So that was his lowest tier for $5. You can give me $5 and you can feel like you paid for it. He had a kind of a deluxe edition for $99, or I guess, you know, albums for $20, physical albums, and then a deluxe version for $100. And then he went out of his way to create like a limited run of 10,000 super special editions, all hand signed by him in a fancy upgraded thing. And again, all my numbers are wrong, but the point stands. And he charged
Brian, I'm running these numbers. They're all wrong.
Okay, good. As I predicted, right again, this guy. but he made a few thousand of an extreme edition available for $500. He ended up being insanely successful by basically ceding all of the territory of the long tail and instead maximizing the profits available at the high end of the tail, at the beginning, at the top parts of the curve. And so when we launched our Rogue's Tavern, we had to acknowledge that somewhere out there are people with the passion and the means who would like to figure out a way to give more than we were asking for it. And so you need to figure out something exclusive for them. It's something that Starbucks has done brilliantly, because Starbucks took a commodity that most people were accustomed to paying literally one U.S. quarter for. They were accustomed to paying 25 cents for a cup of coffee. But by adding so many clever add-ons, they figured out a way that the hardest of the hardcores, the people who enjoyed being in the ambiance of Starbucks, could plausibly walk away spending $7, $8, $9 for a cup of coffee and feel good about their purchase with a modest number of or amount of investment in order to make that happen. So likewise, that's what Trent Reznor did. He figured out a way to take the hardest of the hardcore fans, the people who would derive immense personal pleasure from owning a high end artifact of limited release signed by him personally, and extract enough money that it compensates for everything the long tail might have done.
And that, and to Chris Anderson's credit, in the long tail, he talked about how some of your models, the freemium models or whatever, you have a model that's based on one portion of your audience is actually paying for the rest, and the rest, the freemium stuff is really capture for that funnel. The business model isn't that it's free. The business model is that free is a way to promote and advertise to then get people who want to buy the higher ticket item, which is why we're going to offer After Things Premium. It's a new thing we're going to do.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same.
We've talked a lot about it, and it's about time that we finally launch it. It's ATP. Go ahead and give the pitch, Brian.
The pitch is it's exactly the same, only we describe to you how golden the podcast is just beforehand. We give a very vivid description, and also we're only going to allow 5 people to hear that description.
It's funny. Somebody just mentioned this in the chat, and I remember when I used to do my after school class, which I met Justin, and the subject of music piracy came up. It was over 15 years ago, and one kid said, my idea is this: just sell one album for $1 million. which was funny, and he was meant it as a joke, but it's hilarious. And of course, we just saw that Wu-Tang Clan did that, and they had to find a morally bankrupt person with enough money to go bank and buy it. But that is the other approach, and that's what, like, when they did the giveaway, I think it was of a Prince album in some UK newspaper, was the idea, like, oh, find somebody willing to pay this because they want to ride on the coattails of this thing.
We saw, was it this year or last year? I guess it was last year, but couple albums, including Jay-Z put out an album that was for the first week exclusive to Samsung phones by effectively just monetizing the most important week of sales by way of a corporate sponsorship, although that seems to have given way. Like, all the big albums this year seem to have gone around that, like Taylor Swift and Adele and everything. They've just sort of treated music streaming as radio and kept it off there for the first couple of weeks to maximize album sales, and then they'll list it on Spotify and Apple Music and everything.
It's still experimental. And I remember when, I think it was Radiohead did a pay what you want kind of thing that they did once and they didn't repeat, because they sat back and they realized that, we probably could have got a better price if we sold it to what?
Oh, no. I was just thinking about it. Did you guys hear Radiohead's Spectre?
No, I didn't hear it. But I was just saying, but they that was a thing they did not repeat, where Trent Reznor, tried to come out with sort of a bigger, let me capture, as Brian pointed out, the different audience segments of it. But, now as a executive at Apple, he's figured out the best plan for compensation.
Well, and again, it's like there's value. It's a strange time in my career to look at everything behind me and to wonder, is the value of what those experiences were, is the value in building my brand, is the value in building my list of capabilities and personality, is the value in the money I made for having done it. And it's strange to go back and think about how much I deeply, deeply value the brutality of trying to perform on the streets and the difficulty of trying to pack in 150 shows in 1 year on this insane whirlwind nonstop 200 days on the road tour, and realize that, you know, while the money was good in the latter, not so much in the former, that the real value was just in that the ability to do those things and the ability to regard myself as somebody who can provide those services was truly the most valuable thing that came out of the whole thing.
Yeah, there's, you know, it, all of it is sort of iterative. And so where somebody, art engineer says we got that backward. I don't, as far as I, yes, he was the guy that won the bid to buy the Wu-Tang album. That is correct. That's what we were saying.
Yeah, no. So Martin Scorsese, who famously became reviled for raising the price of an AIDS drug from, I think, like $17 a pill to $200
and has now been
$750. Sorry, and has now been brought in facing federal charges for malfeasance in a previous company. Yeah, bought the Once Upon a Time in Shaolin one off album, which amusingly comes in its contract with a clause that it can be stolen back.
I don't think that was true.
That wasn't true?
No, that was just a made up rumor.
Really?
Huh. Really? Because I guess I don't have time to read this Verge article, but it says, huh. So what was
the
context?
Yes, and their source is this guy Rob Wesley's his one tweet that says, "Hey, look what I found in the contract that I got hold of." It was a hoax.
Oh, got it. What a bummer. So when he says we're getting the urge to call Bill Murray, that was just a reference to the hoax.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, for those of you who don't know, like allegedly there was a clause saying that they could physically steal the album in a heist or caper with any of the members of the Wu-Tang Clan and also Bill Murray. By the way, did you guys watch A Very Murray Christmas, the Netflix special?
Yeah, but if you go to Billboard, Bill Murray Wu-Tang Heist Clause is BS.
It's BS, yeah.
But RZA might steal the album anyways.
No, I watched the very Murray Christmas special, which you know, I think it was I read a review on Variety about it, and it said, you know, it's so slight, you know, it's barely an hour. You know, it's mostly just songs and stuff like that there's little ways that you can nitpick it, but whatever. It's Bill Murray and a bunch of famous people singing Christmas songs. And you know, it's fun.
I like that every time I see RZA written, I say RZA.
Yeah.
I cannot stop.
Digital.
What's that?
Bobby Digital. RZA.
I know. It's like that. What color? You know, like when they do the test with like purples written in orange, and you're like, oh, what color is this?
The Stroop test, yeah.
And I'm just so used to like, and I'm like, if you said, hey, if somebody said, have you heard this new, you know, if you say, you know, RZA, I'm like, I'd be like, I don't know. RZA, oh, yeah, yeah. You know, but if I see it, the brain not function.
That's amazing.
So the answer is, folks, you know, just sell one copy for $1 gazillion, and you're set. Now we've seen what's happened in this interesting evolution of how do we create and package things. We have our digital product, Mr. Justin Robert Young, who is a podcaster and also did The Contender. Give us an update on The Contender, by the way.
So The Contender is I forget where we left off on After Things. We had and we're still dealing with some very, very frustrating supply chain issues where between our manufacturer and Amazon, which is fulfilling everything, we got a bunch of stuff mislabeled. You know, so people are – a lot of people are getting it. You know, we had an extremely gratifying last 48 hours where a lot of people obviously are at home with family, a lot of people playing the game and tweeting us or putting up on Facebook their favorite combinations of stuff and really kind of enjoying the spirit of the game. You know, I had an amazing call with a lot of my friends, you know, back home, which both of you have experienced on some levels, Andrew more than Brian, but our you know, I I love them all very, very dearly, but at times not exactly the most nurturing of people. It is a very killer be killed kind of friendly structure, which in many ways has honed the incisive wit that for which I have made a career on. But at times it's not exactly the place where you bring your macrame art project and say, "Hey, friends, appreciate my creativity." But I got a great call last night where they were all playing the game and having a really, really good time and had very nice things to say about it, which made me smile. You know, it's been bittersweet because, you know, right now we are at kind of now that Christmas is done, we fulfilled the majority of the Kickstarter orders. The last of them should go out over the next week. We are really at the kind of sink or swim phase for this game. And the big bet that we've made needs to kind of start paying off within weeks and months. And we've done, you know, I think everything that we can do, we will continue to kind of send things out. And at this point, it's just about word of mouth. It's about press. It's about, you know, everybody letting the rubber hit the road and the game kind of flying by itself, you know, in a way that, you know, based on the reaction, people seem to really, really, really enjoy it. And you know, a lot of the reviews we're up to, I think, 60 reviews, 58, 59, 60 reviews on Amazon right now. Where
you're 98% five star rating.
What was that?
98%
five star rating.
98%, which I think is really just one dude who is you know, I guess played it with a friend and it wasn't he doesn't
well,
like
apparently all your reviews are paid for in AstroTurf, according to him. You paid for them,
yeah, which, you know, it's very, very sweet of him to say. Which I'll take that. You know, I'll take that. Our praise is so unrestrained and uniform in its enthusiastic jubilee that he would assume that they are robots. You know, but that's fine. You know, I got a text from John, my co-creator on it, who's like, "I think we should respond to him." And I'm like, "You want to know what? Considering how much we need." You know, in the quantities we're going to need people reviewing, you're just going to get that. And that's something that I saw with Andrew's books. You know, when we first started putting it out there and you know, you got all this, you know, you got people who are fans of the podcast, that are fans of Andrew, that read the book and really caught into it. When you have previous communities come out and support a project that they really feel passionate and bonded to, you tend to get on Amazon that has a very conscious reviewer culture, these people that feel like they need to counterbalance things and they feel like they need to be the like, "Well, I don't know. I saw it and I feel it's my moral obligation to respond that it's not the greatest thing on the planet."
I'm going through that with How to Write a Novella in 24 hours, where the first people to review this were people who heard about it from me and who are big fans and supporters of me. And so I started with, you know, just, you know, fantastic number of reviews, and still the reviews are great. I mean, the reviews have been wonderful. I've got, you know, I've had one star review, which somebody was trying to plug somebody else's book, you know, and then said things that weren't technically correct, like, "Oh, it doesn't cover this." And it's like, that's the first chapter, which is to me, it's like,
But by the way, that was the exact same thing in my two-star review, is they wind up plugging another game, which, you know, at some point it's like, you know, you wonder where that comes from.
Yeah, but the thing is like, then when I started getting a couple 4 stars in there, I'm like, I would love, in a perfect world, I would love it to be all 5 stars. But I know I'm skeptical when I look at something and all I see are 5 stars. And so a couple 4 stars in there, anybody listening, please, if you give me a 4-star, I'll cry. No, but a couple 4-star, it makes it real. It does make it real. You just want the overwhelming to be people. You want to find that audience that likes it. And
the chatter I remember reading is, "Beware the you." You know, if you have a bunch of 5-star reviews, nothing, and then a bunch of 1-star reviews, that implies that what you have is either purchased or astroturfed, faked out 5-star reviews, and then the real people coming in like, "I don't understand the hype about it." For example, if I look at one of our fake – let me go to where's the journey at?
what are you trying to say about the journey, Brian?
The journey or the Diamond Club.
Diamond Club certainly has it. Although the funny thing is, like, look at 50 Shades of Grey. 50 Shades of Grey has almost the same thing that the Diamond Club had, because there are people that enthusiastically loved it And then there are people that have a backlash to it and want.
Actually, I'm sorry, I have to stand corrected because The Journey apparently never got popular enough that it got. Apparently, it's just almost all. There's 97% 5-star reviews on The Journey. There's 1% 4-star and 2% 1-star. I'll have to check on the Diamond Club. Diamond Club. There's another Diamond Club about, is there?
Oh yeah, no, there's a whole nother thing that tried to scoop our heat.
Oh, see, there we go. That's a little bit of the U curve right there. 68% 5-stars, 20% 1-stars. But at any rate, and you know, granted, you know, this is something that oh, by the way, look at this. The Diamond Club, if you are in possession of a paperback, they are so rare and so electric that they are going for $10,000.
There's one copy available for $10,000. Man, I have one lying around. I'm going to undercut it by Diamond Club.
I got to tweet this out. This is amazing. I'm sorry. Go ahead, gentlemen.
just curious, like if what other books come up if you click on Diamond Club? Like what are the other?
And that was one of the things that we talked about was how when the thing first came up, the first when it says other customers bought at the very beginning, and I don't have the slides anymore, but customers who bought this item also bought used to have all of our greatest hits, where it was always Andrew Main and Scam School books and all that stuff. So you could tell it was our people buying it. But as the Diamond Club caught fire with the outside community. In other words, the intended demographic of people looking for salacious, you know, mm-hmm. mommy porn type stuff. You saw, and in fact, we look at it right now, we're seeing a bunch of sexy books right now. Fearful Weeks, 29 Days, The Diamond Club, Another Diamond Club. There's Angel Killer, but there's an awful lot of cheesecake and man abs in the middle of all this.
Oh, look, go back. Wait, what's that? One more. What's that number one bestseller right there?
What, The Name of the Devil?
Then the one next to it that says number one bestseller.
How to Write a Novella.
24 hours. Oh, wow. How did that happen?
That's great.
2 months now.
Dude, that's amazing. Congratulations. That's huge. That is fantastic. Now you make me want to go see how Scam School Book 2 scams.
Oh,
school.
All right. Come on. We're not just checking our chart positions.
Dude, this is part of it. This is part of the creative process.
If you're going to – this is sick and disgusting. If you're going to do it, just go check the contender.
Okay. All right. Well, as long as we're doing that, contender. The contender
this
game.
This is disgusting. Guys, don't. Please don't.
No, it's terrible. It's terrible. Look at that, though. 58 customer reviews.
58, and they're mostly 5-star.
I heard from a guy that it's just a knockoff of the totally original Cards Against Humanity. It's had nothing to do with apples and oranges. And
apples to apples, yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, he hated that, too, which is fine.
Look, here's the important thing is – I don't know. I guess the lesson is what? Cater to your hardcore crowd. Figure out a way to, if somebody wants to give you more money, give them a way to do so. Figure out how to leverage your audience to play the review games because the review game matters. Anything else?
Yeah, I think the thing that I've learned is what you said there is that know your audience. Know who those people are. Promote to those people. And I think that sometimes the mistake that happens is that people will have something. Some things can go wide and some things will not. The Martian was a great movie that everybody could, you know, my mom would enjoy the movie The Martian. My mom would not enjoy the book The Martian. She's not going to sit down and read a book, 300-page book, going into perchlorates and all this sort of stuff about living on Mars. It's not for her.
Right.
Well, she'll sit down for 2 hours and do that. And so when it comes to storytelling, it's understanding where your audience is and when your audience is.
Yeah.
Tell you what, I think your mom would read this new book that I'm reading if it had a nom de plume. I'm reading Andrew's new book right now, and it is super fun and really great. And I feel like, yeah, if it was a nom de plume that you just gave it to your mom as a soft cover. I'd be curious to see what her thoughts would be. So I think it's super readable.
You know who really likes my stuff is my brother. And my brother's really? Been, he's read both of my Jessica Blackwood books, and here's an FBI agent. And then he had one comment, and he was right. I'm like, I don't even believe I did that because I know that's a mistake because I talk about, you know, the gun clip being empty, and I meant to say magazine. And it's one of those things that I know enough to correct somebody else, but I won't stop myself from doing it and using clip and magazine interchangeably. They're different.
Dude. Well, you know, I'll tell you what. I think it's been a hell of a year for all of us in terms of our own – creative journeys, a lot of really, really, really fun stuff. And, you know, I think there's no reason why next year will not be just as super awesome.
I'm very excited to see what's going to happen with you, Justin, because you've taken a very, very bold step. You have taken where Brian and I sort of eased our way into kind of the businesses and the things we're done, you know, we've done. You made this very big decision in a, not to mention a very big year for you getting married too, to yeah. say, hey, I've got this nice corporate gig that has, you know, helped improve my quality of life considerably since I worked in a dank sweatshop in Margate, Florida, to now saying, hey, I'm going to try to survive as an independent by my wits alone. And I think for after things, it's going to be a very exciting thing to follow.
Well, you know, here was the biggest lesson for me when it came to making that decision is that at some point, I think it looks a lot more sudden from the outside than it felt for me, because it was like there was ultimately just a box that I had of time when it came to the Go Games job, right? Like, you know, there was just only so much time I was ever able to do. And it was like, to get beyond, what, you know, the amount that I could do independently, like it just kind of had to go, like, or else I would just sort of start to let projects wither and die as they came down the pike. And the projects that were coming down the pike were becoming more interesting and rad. And thankfully I got a really good example of that almost immediately upon, you know, making the decision to leave the Go Game with this Discovery VR thing where, if I was still at the Go Game, that's something I would have had to pass on. You know, I would have either had to damage my relationship with Go Games, or pass on it. And I probably would have, you know, considering it was like iffy on whether or not it was going to happen until a week before it happened, that would have been something that I probably would have just had to say thanks but no thanks. And you know, that's really what is super interesting now. It's just that, like, hey, there's this whole other world for me that now is kind of open, and the ability to take advantage of it is really what I bought by leaving. You know, this kind of time commitment, as much as I enjoyed it and as lucrative as it was.
Well, and it's very much a gamble, right? But the reverse is a gamble too. As long as you were at the Go Game, you knew exactly how much money you would get for, you know, 40 to 60 hours per week. Like that was a locked in value. Now, on the one hand, yes, you do experience considerable risk as you try to evolve multiple properties at the same time. You're taking, you know, but you've unlocked 40 to 60 hours and you've given yourself the chance to say yes to extraordinary circumstances, you know, the kind of thing. I mean, you know, 5 years ago, if you know, lightning struck and as you and I are just farting around doing the BB Live show, just starting NSFW, if you said, hey, you two are going to be tapped by Discovery Channel, one of the biggest media conglomerate giants out there, that and given the opportunity to be pioneers, literal pioneers, first in the in breed of an emerging new type of storytelling, and that you know, it's going to be a perfect fit and you guys are going to be have a great time and make good money doing it. I mean, you know, that's amazing to me that becomes possible. And only yeah. more of it will happen after this.
I think part of it too is you sort of sit back and you realize what's in your DNA. And I see this in you guys, and I hope I see it sort of myself. I have a magic book that's out called Magic and Mischief. And I did a pre-sale. I said, okay, I'll do a pre-sale because the book is ready and I'm doing my little, my last minute, you know, corrections and stuff on it. And I'll do a pre-sale on my mailing list with the idea of, like, I know that there's a week turnaround from the printer to when I get copies. So I get my finished version. I have it. I have my rough copy. It's great. I mean, look, everything's supposed to be, but I need to correct. I make all my fixes and my corrections. I get somebody to give me some notes. I turn it in. I go to the publisher, the people who do the printing for it, and their 1 week turnaround has now turned to 2 weeks. Right, and yeah. I'd said shipping in December, and I find this out, you know, December 7th or 6th or whatever.
Yeah.
I should have probably proactively have gone and said, hey, is this going to hold true? I assume they would have been off Christmas vacation, but I didn't realize in December everything was going to double. So I have all the books shipped to my parents' house because I'm supposed to be in Florida the day before it would have arrived at my house. So books arrive at my parents' house the day I get into Florida. So I drive to my parents' house to go fulfill all these orders. And I'm fulfilling orders, and I realize I am 10 books short.
Oh, jeez. Oh,
no. Okay. Now, in some of these orders, and these were orders that came in after I said shipping in December, but I'm like, I don't want to be that guy that sends them an excuse and says, hey, my shipper did this or whatever. So I'm up late. I'm like at 3 a.m., you know, at Christmas Eve morning or, you know, the morning of the 23rd or whatever, having my printer drop ship copies to places. It's a $30 book, and I'm paying $35 to ship these things to different places around the world.
Been there.
Yeah. And it was funny because I told my dad, I said, afterwards, woke up next morning, I said, and I went to the post office to take care of everything, and then the rest of them I paid extra to have them drop ship. And I said, yeah, I said, I lost money on some of my orders. He said, what do you mean? Like, oh, I had to pay more to ship. I'm like, well, you didn't lose order, just cutting your profit. I'm like, no, Dad. I got paid $32 for this book. I paid $35 to print and have it shipped to him. And he's like, oh. I'm like, yeah, but it's principle. You know, it's just the thing that if I said I'm going to do this thing and it's within my power to do that thing, then I'm going to do that thing. So
yeah, and it's just the only way. And we've faced that now where we are with the contender where we've had all these screw ups and it's like, man, there is a part of me that really just wants to stop using wishy-washy descriptors for where the problems happened and start pointing fingers at more specific elements and start saying this is why this happened or this is why this didn't happen or waiting to fix the problem until we get compensation from other elements that might have screwed stuff up. And it's like, but you can't do it. I mean, like nobody is interested in you winning. No one is interested in you in the order of operations it takes to get the thing right. They just want the thing right because from their perspective, you are all of it. You are every stage of the process and you get all the credit, but you get all the blame. And that's a huge thing to remember.
Well, and also, I don't know, it's that it reminds me of the algorithm tit for tat in The Prisoner's Dilemma is that, you know, every time you act like the kind of guy who fulfills on a promise, even when it costs some money, you gain more of a reputation as that guy and more you become a more reliable commodity that people feel good about giving money to or hiring for their big corporate event or for, you know, buying thousands of your book for, you know, whatever. I mean, it's
And it makes it easier certainly to deal with when you have people who are frustrated or criticism, when you know in your heart you did everything you could do, when you know that you did everything in your heart. Because if you're feeling guilty, if like, yeah, I could have done this or whatever, you tend to be defensive. You tend to be – you want to push back and argue and whatever. But if somebody's like, hey, you know, you promised me this book was going to ship here and I got it January. It's like, yes, I promised it would ship in December and it shipped in December and I even lost money shipping that in December to make sure that happened.
Now, on the flip side, and I don't know if this is a rite of passage of graduation of finally entangling yourself in bigger, more important moneyed interests, but like the 15-year run of touring colleges, when that was my primary gig, there were times we would do things like – there was one gig that got double booked, and in order to make things right, we were looking at chartering a private jet where I would make no money on the gig just so we could do both and keep our word for it, right? And then it finally hit a stumbling block. You know, that was always my attitude is if it's physically possible, let's do it. But then we get to a point, you know, with the TV show, there was two or three college bookings that they were like, no, you can't. That's in the middle of production. You signed a piece of paper saying that we get first right of refusal for your time from point A to point B. We are not going to give you days off to run off and do these shows. And it kind of broke my heart to finally turn into what in my mind I thought of as one of those guys, those people who just say, yeah, sorry, can't make that gig, LOL. And that was a hard thing for me to deal with. Did you have to do anything like that when you were doing your TV show, Andrew?
I made sure that any prior commitments I had still held true, that anything that I had prior that was part of my negotiation was that, and that I had would state up front, I have X, Y, and Z here. And so there was a couple things that I carved out and said, you know, specifically that we have to plan around that. That was a condition because I just didn't want to be – because I also like I knew that, you know, TV, it's great. There's this TV thing, but other engagements I have, I might need 5 years from now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in my case, you know, it was very much, you know, the word I told my manager was I was like if I have to do a do whatever it takes to make them okay with this. If they need a free show to make it right, we will schedule a free show that I will go.
Yeah,
on my own
you get
time.
A lot of times it's easier. Like I was at Taco Bell and this guy goes up and I'm waiting for my mobile order. I watch this guy go to the counter and they're busy. It's lunchtime. It's busy and this guy's outraged. He's outraged and finally goes, I want to speak to a manager. Later, because I goes, this is an outrage. You've got a line out the door. You got da 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 da. And it's like she's only given X amount of dollars to hire people. It's not her fault. And then he says, you know, I don't want to leave a bad Yelp review. And I'm like, oh, my God. And this woman and I just look at each other and we just complete strangers. We lock eyes and roll. And he goes like, this is, you know, I'm pretty important at NBC. And I lost it.
Williams.
Yeah. I lost it right there. And I'm sitting there waiting for my food. I go, what do you do at NBC? What department are you with? And he's like, I'm like, and I go, dude, you just name drop Yelp and NBC. Are you serious? And I just called him out on that because he was just, and it's just, he's like, well, you know, it's, you know, they got a lot of people here. I'm like, I said, I know these people are sweet. They're trying their hardest, but seriously, dude. And it was just, you know, it was, I don't know if I should have said it, but I did. And I actually felt kind of good to sort of drop him on that. Yeah, my point was he's like, well, what are you going to do to make this right? Like, and I'm like, you're really like, I'm looking at the other, this one behind him. We're like, we can't believe you're now extorting this woman for free food.
Yeah.
Because you had to wait.
And the funny thing is that, and this kind of comes into, you know, with customer service, implied or understood power dynamics are a huge thing, that when you give money to someone without an immediate, like, you know, Amazon in part is as successful as it is and became successful in e-commerce because you had a understood relationship with them that within 12 hours of you buying something, you got a shipping confirmation, right? Like, and it's something that's like kind of lost now, you know, that like when we think about like e-commerce getting big in the 90s, it was like, is my credit card going to get stolen? All right. We've solved this problem by way of showing big things, e-verify the security lock or whatever, right? So that kind of became a relic. But the thing that's still here now and is almost more important now that so many people sell things is like, how fast do I get it? If I pay for expedited shipping, does it mean expedited shipping? And Amazon was very crucial in understanding, all right, let's create the most insane logistics delivery, sophisticated delivery system in the modern age to get these things from point A to point B as fast as possible using robots and the kid slaves from Temple of Doom, whatever. You know, like let's just make sure that all of this gets from point A to point B. And that's huge when you think of when you're selling yourself, right? Or when you buy something that you have like how many times for all of us have you gotten emails because either something is miscommunicated or is delayed or something, and that first email comes in hot as a oven that's just like, hey, like you stole my money. This is, you know, this is an absolute outrage. And it's because for them, their story is it's gotten to that point, right? Like they feel so, so angry. They feel so taken advantage of that even just you saying, whoa, hold on, you might have missed your tracking email. We got one to the contender that was like at this point you should just refund it because you've obviously this is just an ex, you know, this is a theft and everything. And turns out he got a delivery. It was delivered to him the day before he wrote the email, and we have like all the tracking stuff. So either he got it sent to an address that he didn't realize, or you know, a tracking email was sent to him. But it's like you have to understand that when people come in super angry, when people come in super upset, they're on a journey that you don't, that you're not at, right? They don't view you like you view yourself. And at any kind of kindness, any kind of like way to shift that narrative of like, oh, hey, like, so we've had all these problems with the mislabelings. It's like, hey, sorry about that. This is a known issue. We've documented it. We're going to take care of it ASAP. Please send us an email. We'll get you your product as soon as possible. Immediately, it goes from you robbed me to I'm your favorite person. You know,
that was when we did our magic mailer business. That was a big. We would get these, and 9 times out of 10, they missed. You know, they screwed up. There was some mistake they made or whatever, and you get these angry sort of. And then our attitude is always, you know, don't. Just say, how can we fix this? Let's make this right. And it was, you know, 9 times out of 10, it was a complete 180. You know, it was just that you go from being a thief because they're so used to other people going, well, you're stupid. You didn't do this or whatever. And it's like, we have nothing to gain by that. You know, yeah, we know they made a mistake, but I don't need to rub their face in it. I don't care. And sometimes we make a mistake, but we just own up to it. And then it just, everything's cordial. And I forgot what it was. Is I had somebody sent me this, forgot what it was. It was just one of these you know, agitated emails. And then I'm like, oh, let me take care of this, da-da-da. 24 hours later, hey, I'm sorry I was up really late and blah, blah, blah. They're apologizing for all of this. And it's like, whatever. It's fine. You know, it's you thought – you didn't realize you were talking to a person who wanted to help you. Now that you know there's a person who wants to help you, we're all cool.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's been the hallmark of every great e-commerce company. You know, Zappos. Zappos is a great example. Amazon, for you know, as automated as they are, has avoided the kind of cold reputation that Google has because Amazon is very customer focused and will always take the customer's word over anything.
You ever talk to their rep? Like, if you have a problem with the shipping thing, meaning if OnTrack has been assigned to deliver it and you have a problem, it's the only time I ever have to call Amazon about something not getting there because it's OnTrack. But you go to their website, you say talk to them, somebody will call you right back.
Yeah.
And they've realized there was that fear of like, oh, you don't want to spend so much money doing customer support. Well, if you get your infrastructure right, you don't have to do as much customer support. Yeah. If things really work right the way they're supposed to, then you get fewer calls and people don't want to have to get to that point. Now Amazon's in this interesting position because FedEx dropped the ball on them this season. You know, a lot of missed orders, a lot of missed shipping. There were rumors going around that Amazon had actually leased their own planes to handle a lot of their package movement. Amazon said nothing to the effect about the fact that they did that. They didn't quite deny it. And they've just pushed a statement like, well, we look forward to working with all of our partners, blah, 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 which is code for Amazon's going to start its own logistics and shipping company because they don't want to rely on everybody else like they've been doing.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, though. We had a ton of people that were getting their contender decks on Christmas Eve, on Christmas Day. Like, you know, they were turning and burning.
Win it now.
All right. Look, this is a double plus ultra triple XL packed episode of After Things and Weird Things. This was almost a 3-hour rock block of weird ideas that we were pumping in everyone's brains.
Absolutely.
My pick is go watch the SpaceX webcast, and it's a very good example of how this company is openly trying to communicate their goals. You have people working for a $1 billion private corporation that's involved in government, in military contracting, NASA contracting, that does not hide the fact there's secretly a Mars cult that wants to go to Mars and build an entire new city, a new civilization on Mars. That's the thing that James Bond has to go through 5 layers of security and sneak into the basement to find the blueprints and to find the replica model that Mars. Like, yeah, no.
Put it on Front Street.
Call us crazy, but we'll see you there. Watch this webcast and you get to see some crazy dreamers.
Heck yes. My pick is literally just do anything with Star Wars this week. Actually, watch Star Wars Rebels. How about that?
Yeah, my pick is go see Star Wars again because I want to talk about Star Wars.
Dude. It's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.